This is the Medicast, January 28th, 2008.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 102. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome all of you to this show. If you are a brand new subscriber, I want to welcome you to the Medicast, whether you've subscribed via the Zune Marketplace or iTunes or using some other version of Podcatcher, welcome to the Medicast. I hope you go over to the website and check out all of the other back episodes, as well as all of the other articles and great information that you can find over at medicast.com. And for all of you longtime subscribers, I want to thank you all for staying tuned, for all of your comments, your questions, your suggestions, and yes, your corrections when I've made errors, all of which makes this show such a great community effort here at the Medicast Podcast. I also want to thank those of you who have been over to the iTunes store and left your praises or suggestions over at the iTunes store on the Medicast page. If you are interested and inclined to do so, you can go over and leave your own comments and rate the Medicast podcast there. I always appreciate it, and it's one of those things that helps out keeping the Medicast high up in the ratings on the medical pages at iTunes. I also want to point out some of the great reviews that have been put up over there, and even the reviews that haven't really given me a stellar response, I still want to thank you for taking the time. Specifically, Sir5555 left this comment: takes forever to get to the topic, scored me 1 out of 5 stars, and said Jamie meanders his way through the show and takes forever to get to the actual topic of the episode. And he continues on to make a few other comments, but he really wanted me to get to the show on Glasgow Coma Scale. And I first of all want to thank you for taking the time to make that comment. Remember, I am aware of all of your input and try to keep up with the show and performing and producing it in such a way that makes it useful to you in whatever it is you're doing. But I also take some time to talk about what I've been doing. I consider this a conversation between us as individuals and not just me talking out there to the thousands of listeners. You all are important, and I want to make sure that I get content to you in an appropriate fashion, but part of this is me having a conversation with you as well. I would also remind you, if you are subscribing via the iTunes store link, that most of the episodes come in a format that allows you to skip to different chapters. I put those chapter markers in there. It takes a significant amount of time to do that, but I want you to be able to skip to and re-listen to sections of the show. So if you subscribe using the iTunes store link, you can listen to it either on your computer or if you have an iPod, you can listen that way. You can skip forwards and backwards using the chapter markers that are in place there. Not every one of the episodes that gets put on that particular feed comes in that format, but most of them do. Occasionally, I run into a technical problem that keeps me, for some reason, from doing that, but most of those episodes are in the .m4a format, and I do include the chapter marker links in those shows. So if you are tired of listening to me ramble on, you can skip to the next topic, the next news story, the next tip or medication, and get through the show to the content that you want to receive. But whenever you have a comment, whether it's good or bad, as long as it's positive and gives me something constructive to work with, I will try to implement it in some way into the show. Thanks a lot. Since I seem to have shifted into listener mail mode, I guess I'll continue on with some more listener email. I got an email from Bob a listener who is currently an I-85, an EMT Intermediate 85 here in the United States, and he's looking for a way to prepare for some National Registry prep information on National Registry I-85 level of skills. And I was able to point him in a couple of directions and was able to help out with that. But basically, you can find whole bunch of information over at nremt.org that has a complete listing of all of the PDFs that you can download with information on the different skill sheets. Those are the things I use when I do different skills here on the show, all of which you can find over at nremt.org. If you do a little poking around and digging there, there's a lot of information, and you will be able to find out some of the differences in the skill levels and expected training available for National Registry providers of all different levels. I also found a couple of other links that I sent out to Bob, and I'm going to dig through and find those links from the email I sent to him and look for a post later this week on some of the different skill levels in the National Registry requirements, and a couple of links for you out there that are in the I-85 program or maybe upgrading to the I-99 level of skill. Either way, we'll have some of that posted later in the week in an article I'll post up on the medicast.com blog. I got another email from listener Irk from Sydney, Australia, and he says, "Good day, Jamie." So I'll say, "Good day, Irk." And he wanted to know if what we do about educating people on calling 911. And this is in reference to the death of Heath Ledger recently, where the individual who found him called his girlfriend first and then called 911. And was there any kind of push here to educate people about where to call and how to call 911? And, you know, Irk and everybody else, there is an important message to get out, and that is that we need to educate people on how to access the system and really pound that in. I think everybody knows you in the United States, you dial 911. In other places, it might be 999 or other numbers, but we need to teach people how to access the emergency system and when to appropriately access the emergency system. And usually we're talking about people calling it too much and sending us people or using the ambulance to transport themselves to the hospital inappropriately. But the other side of that coin is that there are people who don't quite know what to do to access the system and maybe don't access it when they should be accessing it. So good points there, Irk, and I certainly appreciate that. It's something we can all do better in educating our people in the street and our patients on when they should be calling us as part of our patient care. Is saying you called us at the right time, and when this happens in the future, make sure you call us again. Those kind of things can go a long way towards educating our patients. I got an email from listener Heath, a longtime friend of the MedicCast, and he sends me quite a bit of stuff throughout the course of the week. I don't always pass all of it on to you, but I do look at it and keep in touch. But Heath has found a couple of really poignant articles out there dealing with EMS providers, whether on duty or off, that have been killed on the highways while responding or arriving in motor vehicle accident situations. And this has to do with us being really careful, especially in inclement weather situations, of how other traffic is responding to us. And these people are getting struck and killed as pedestrians on the roadway while they're trying to perform rescue situations. And we need to be aware of this and make sure that we're exiting our vehicles in a safe manner, make sure that we are positioning our vehicles in such a way as to provide a barrier to oncoming traffic or provide a more visible object and obstacle to oncoming traffic. And we need to do those things to make sure that we are not getting ourselves killed while trying to do and help other people. So he thanks so much for sending that information in. Finally, I got an email from listener Eric, and he and I have kind of had an ongoing conversation via the EMS blog over at medicast.com and looking at a past article I posted there. And this has to do with a This is back in episode 79. I talked a little bit about stimulant drinks and alcohol consumption and my belief that all you end up with is with a wide awake drunk. You don't end up with people who have further impairment or either more sober or further impaired as a result of having a combination of caffeine and alcohol. And he had had an experience where he was at a party and a girl had had a Red Bull and vodka drink, and that she had had a very negative experience and then ended up being taken to the hospital. And his response was that he believed that this may have been a result of the caffeine in the Red Bull or the other herbs and things that are in the Red Bull having an adverse effect on her in addition to the vodka. And I really didn't have a response beyond the point that I went and checked some of my other resources to make sure that there hadn't been further study on this. And so look forward. I'm going to be doing some more on this in the Med of the Week today. I'm going to talk about caffeine in specific as a drug later on in this show. Time for the link of the week, and this week's link of the week is to the Medicast Live. Coming up in just a couple of weeks, I will be talking about a topic that I think is near and dear to all our hearts, getting on with those people who are near and dear to all our hearts. Since it's just before Valentine's Day, February 12th at 10 p.m., that's a Tuesday night, folks, you can call in live and share with the panel of experts that I will have talking about living with EMS providers, dealing with us when we're stressed out, helping us out when we're studying to achieve new provider levels or degrees in EMS, all of that we do because of the assistance or lack of assistance from our significant others. So we're going to have on the show as a special guest, both myself and Rick Rosati, as well as our wives. And you'll be able to hear a little bit about their trials and tribulations living with an EMS provider. And I'm still working on getting someone in from the mental health profession that can talk to us about open communication. I've had some training in that area, so if I need to, I'll fill in myself. But we're going to be talking about living with EMS providers, how we can get along better with our spouses or significant others, and ways that maybe they can work to get along better with us. I always believe we need to work on helping ourselves change first, but sometimes we can make some helpful suggestions on keeping the communication lanes open and helping them to understand how we can deal with our stress better, and they can help us do that. So we'll be talking about that coming up in just a couple of weeks, and you can do that over at medicastlive.com, and you'll learn a little bit more about that. Follow the link in the show notes, and you can register and get ready to listen for free. Time to jump on into this week's news, and I'll lead off with a story that has to do with our mandate to be preventative medicine providers as well as emergency medicine providers. Remember that section of your EMT class or your paramedic class or whatever your training program was that talked about prevention being part of providing medical care? Well, in this case, one of the things we can do to deal with prevention is to make sure that people in our communities are learning to use CPR and learning how to access the emergency management system. It goes back to that letter we got in from IRC. And part of that program is teaching CPR. CPR includes information on heart attack, includes information on strokes, on how to access the emergency management system. All of that happens when people learn CPR, as well as improving the chances of somebody who does suffer a sudden cardiac arrest, because bystander CPR, as we all know, is just so important. I found this link to an article from the American Heart Association saying that only about 15 to 30% of people who have heart attacks and go into cardiac arrest get assistive help from bystanders. 15 to 30% are the only ones getting CPR. Folks, that's just ridiculous. CPR is not that hard to perform and not that hard to learn. And it comes from us getting into our communities along with other healthcare personnel and teaching more people CPR. You want to set a goal for yourself in the coming year? If you're a CPR instructor, you need to get out there and teach an additional class at some community location, a church, a civic organization, a school, someplace. teach CPR. If you're not a CPR instructor, guess what your goal is going to be? You need to go out there and get your CPR instructor's card. You can be a BLS provider and have a CPR instructor's card. You do not have to be an ALS provider to do that. So look around your community and find a way to get those jobs done. The next item in the news goes hand in hand with that last article, and this is an article talking about combining innovations in technology and community teaching to increase survival rates of patients both in the hospital and in the community. And this is talking about general education, but it's also talking about teaching CPR. Again, 150,000 cardiac arrests in the United States each year outside of hospitals, and yet 15 to 30% of them are the only ones getting any kind of bystander CPR. So we need to do more to teach people to do that, and we need to do more to increase the use of new technology innovations that will assist us in providing quality CPR. Remember, good, high-quality compressions is key to getting CPR done, and for all of you ALS providers out there, that is a BLS skill. That is something that we need to be focusing on, is getting those BLS skills performed well in the field. And that may mean us doing it. That may mean us providing good oversight on the process that's going on while we're getting our ALS equipment together and in gear. So this is something we need to be on top of. And there are good tools out there that provide things like tips and hints on when to ventilate somebody. There are CPR assistive devices that tell you when you're providing adequate compressions, rate, depth, and positioning. All of these things make it easier to perform CPR in the field. You know, if you put one of those pad devices on the chest and put a bystander there and told them to keep pressing, and as long as they saw green and kept it in the green, they were good to go. This would be an easy way to get somebody to do CPR, even if they've never done it before, because they would be in the right position and they would be knowing when they perform correct compression ratios. Really great stuff, and I am glad to see that these people are talking about this. Again, goes hand in hand with the last article. We need to be out there educating folks, but we also need to be making sure that we're using appropriate technology advances as they come along. Let's move out of cardiac arrest and look at the arrival of blood clots in our system. And we all know that serious broken bones, recent surgeries, all increase our risk of throwing a blood clot, getting a DVT, deep venous thrombosis, or also having that clot move up farther in the system and causing a pulmonary embolism. So we've known about that for some time. We've also known that recent travel can cause an increased risk for throwing a DVT or having a pulmonary embolism. What we didn't know, and what has come out recently in an article from the Archives of Internal Medicine, which is from the a companion product of the Journal of American Medical Association, and what they have found in this study is that they are demonstrating that there is a risk for patients with relatively minor injuries also to have an increased risk of throwing a blood clot. And this is people that can have something like an ankle sprain or a serious muscle bruise in their leg. All of these things can also increase a person's risk. So when you're getting that history, and remember, we're all working hard to get good histories in the field, right? We can be asking questions now when somebody's got signs of a DVT, when somebody has signs of a pulmonary embolism ongoing, we can find out a little bit more about what their prior risk factors were and pass that on to the hospital. Now, they should be asking those questions too, but maybe we can save some time in the diagnosis process and help narrow the field a little bit for them. The other side of that is we may not be seeing a clot happening, but we may have one occur in our presence. And if we already know the history of what's going on, we can keep in the back of our mind, hey, you know what? This person has sudden onset of pain in the leg, or they have a sudden onset of chest pain that's moving around, shortness of breath. This could be a pulmonary embolism if you've been treating somebody with a minor leg injury, maybe at a sporting event. So just something to keep in mind, and I always try to bring these little studies up when they come across my radar. I'll wrap up the news today with a look at children's health insurance programs. You know, it was a big issue a little while ago when it was dropped and not signed into law to expand the coverage of children in the United States under health insurance programs. And a lot of information was thrown out there about cost and savings and everything else. We're in the middle of an election year, and it's important for us to keep our eyes open to information about how we can save money and how we can provide for coverage for people and still do it in a fiscally responsible way. And this particular story I found looks at a program called Healthy Kids, a locally funded health insurance program in the state of California that has, in the past year, saved $7.3 million by preventing unnecessary child hospitalizations via the emergency department. These children now have access to a primary care provider because of the insurance program, and they're able to seek appropriate care with their parents and not have to access the emergency system in order to provide some care for relatively minor problems and injuries. And this is saving millions of dollars. In fact, if this program had been California-wide, had not just been available as a pilot program in certain areas, this study says that they could have saved over $30 million just by providing access to this very simple program. So it's something to keep in mind, something that we are very aware of on the street as we end up transporting patients to the hospital who may not otherwise need transport, but our hands are tied. We can't say no, we have to take them, and they really have no other recourse in some cases to seek medical care in other ways. This is just another way we can avert some of the ER overcrowding issues and take some of the pressure off our country's EMS systems, and something that I am happy to see. Well, that wraps up the news, and that means it's time for this week's tip and trick of the week. And this week, I'm going to talk about something a little different. I'm going to talk about some of the future standards that are out there and being looked at very closely right now for EMS education and provider levels in the future in the United States. And I don't know if any of you or many of you are even aware that this standard is coming down the pipe and in fact is supposed to be starting to be implemented as early as 2010. But I know in the state of Maryland, we are moving to adopt this new standard over time. And I don't know if the rest of you were aware of what's going on. So I thought I would point you, first of all, via the links in the show notes, to some sites that can show you more about it. And I'm also going to go over a brief overview of what the new EMS education standards are looking to do. There's also a link to the draft standards site from the National EMS Education site that is put up, and you can actually go and look at these standards. There's a version 1.0 and now a new version 2.0, and you can actually comment on those standards if you see something there that you'd like to see changed. This standard is very comprehensive in the way it's looking at things. It describes every aspect. You know, think about your EMS classes. Think about all of the chapters and the sections in those chapters. This looks at and provides a link to directly seeing the changes and proposed levels of care for each of the new provider levels. And you'll be able to see exactly what those educational standards are for each of those topic areas. So I urge you to head over and take a look at the links that you'll find in the show notes for the show. And of course, if you receive the Medicast newsletter, you will actually get those show notes links sent directly to you in your email. The new proposed standards are going to have four basic levels of care, just like they do now. Currently, we have first responder EMTB, EMTI, and EMT paramedic, at least as far as any kind of national standard goes. The new proposed levels have some different naming choices in them, but they generally refer to the same standard of care for each of those levels. The new proposed levels and scope of practice include emergency medical responder, which is similar to the existing first responder status. Primary focus would be on initiating immediate life-saving care to critical patients who access the emergency medical system. They would provide and have to possess a basic knowledge and skills necessary to provide these life-saving interventions while awaiting additional EMS response, and then to assist higher-level comprehensive personnel at the scene and during transport. Now, this is part of the comprehensive EMS system approach that this new program is going to be using. And then they would have other additional levels beyond emergency medical responder. Emergency medical technician, our EMT, would be focusing primarily on basic emergency medical care and transport for the critical care and emergency patients. Critical and emergency patients who access the EMS system. And this is important. This is the lowest level, as it is now in the state or in the United States, of the transport provider. The emergency medical responder earlier is really a scene first response style of EMS care. The EMT is the lowest level of transport care according to the new standard. This person would possess, as an EMT, the basic knowledge and skills necessary to provide patient care and transportation. They would also function as a part of the, again, comprehensive EMS systems response under medical oversight. They would have emergency medical technician interventions of their own with basic equipment typically found on most ambulances, and they would be a link between the EMS scene and the hospital. And that's all part of that systems approach. Then you move into the advanced emergency medical technician, an advanced EMT. This correlates roughly with the EMT I-85 and I-99 profiles right now. And this is going to be called an advanced EMT. And they would again have the provision of basic and some limited advanced emergency medical care and transport for critical and emergency patients who access the system. This person would possess basic knowledge and skills necessary to provide for patient care and transport, and they would also function as part of this comprehensive systems approach. They would perform interventions with basic and some advanced equipment, typically found on an ambulance, and they would be a link again from the scene to the emergency healthcare system. This would be something that EMTIs of different types and other state advanced provider levels would be possibly transferring over to. Now we move into the final of the four levels of care, and this is paramedic. No more EMT-P. This is going to be just paramedic. Paramedic would be an allied health professional whose primary focus is to provide advanced emergency medical care for critical and emergency patients accessing the system. And the key part of that first sentence is they are going to be considered allied health professionals. This places them on par with other areas of allied health and really sets the bar that they are going to be probably requiring an associate's degree at least for paramedic training or some equivalent number of hours of training. No more these just certificate programs or academy programs without some other additional training beyond the minimal certificate requirements. And this is something we talked about a month or so ago when we talked about the new national registry requirements that they were going to require accreditation. This accreditation is going to require at least the number of hours that would be equivalent to a degreed program and a lot of the same training that a degree program would provide. And so I think this is kind of setting that stage for what the advanced provider level paramedic is going to be in under the future guidelines. So this is a quick look at that. What does that really mean? Where does that leave us out there as providers in the field? Well, let me tell you a little bit about what that means. One of the things in the links you'll find is you can click on those different topic areas. So what does this mean in regards to medication administration? What is the understanding level going to be with each of these provider levels? What is that going to mean for the providers? Well, within the document over at the National Emergency Medical Services Education.org site, NEMSED, okay, .org, you can find a link to all of this. And what they've done is they've taken each of these topic areas and broken them down into simple depth or the depth of training and the breadth of the training. You know, how deep into the topic area are they going to go, and how broad are they going to have an understanding of the topic area? So at the emergency medical responder level, that first responder level, they're going to have a simple depth and a simple breadth understanding of their topic. And this is, if we were looking at medications, for example, this would mean they would know the names, basic effects, basic indications, routes of administration, and doses for any medications that they administer in their scope of practice. Just the basics of administering meds that they would have to administer. If you move up to the EMT level, they are going to move from a simple depth to a fundamental depth. They're going to have a deeper understanding of medication knowledge and still having that simple breadth, a pretty narrow breadth of understanding of just what they are dealing with. This would be names, actions, as well as indications, contraindications, complications, as well as routes of administration, and then side effects, and also some of the drug interactions that might occur, and then the doses, individual doses for their medications administered, probably doubling the amount of knowledge they're going to need for their medications in their scope of practice. As you move up to the advanced EMT, all the prior information is going to be required, and they're going to move to a fundamental depth and a foundational breadth of understanding. Fundamental depth is still the same as the EMT, but these people are going to need to have a better breadth, a better width of their knowledge, if you will, of this topic area. And they're still going to have the same basic understanding of some of the things: names, actions, indications, contraindications, complications, routes of administration, side effects, interactions, and doses. But in addition to that, they're going to need to have a broader understanding of what those medications do and their effects. Finally, you move up to the paramedic level if you're looking at the medication topic area, and this is where they have all the other information, and they're going to need to have a complex depth of knowledge of their medications, complex understanding of the pharmacological effects, and a comprehensive breadth of understanding. This is that broad, broad scope of practice in understanding their topic area in medications. This is going to be names, actions, indications, contraindications, complications, routes of administration, side effects, interactions, and doses, just like everybody else. But they're going to require the paramedic to understand more about the action at maybe the cellular level, more understanding of specifically how these different medications affect the body and what other side effects to expect. They're going to need to understand more about the drug interaction process. So this goes from, you know, really having simple things, not even having contraindications. You know, when you're providing life-saving skills and medication access, like using an EpiPen, there is no contraindication for an EpiPen when administered to a patient in anaphylaxis. You give them the EpiPen. And the same thing is true for first responders under the new scope of practice. But then as you move up into those transport levels of care from the EMT through the advanced EMT into the paramedic, you're looking at having an increasingly broad and deeper understanding of each topic area. So I hope that helps you understand where some of the new standards are heading. You can check out the links. These documents are really long and have a lot of information. So if you really want to understand more, you're going to have to check out the links in the show notes over at medicast.com. And that's this week's tip and trick of the week. Time to move on into this week's tip and trick of the week. And I'm going to look at the medication effects, the drug-like effects of caffeine. Now, all of us probably consume caffeine in one way or another and have varying degrees of caffeine addiction in our lives. Maybe you don't, and if you don't, that's probably a very good thing for you. But for those of us that consume caffeine, or for those of us that want to know a little bit more about how caffeine is affecting our patients, I will point you to a couple of different things. First of all, there's a great article at Wikipedia, and I always urge you to use caution at Wikipedia, but if it is a referenced, well-referenced article, you can probably trust it. And in this case, this article has a lot of great information and seems to jive up with some of the other multitudinous sources I found about caffeine. And because it's all in one place, I think it's a better resource because it's centrally located. I also will point you to the Medline Plus site over at the National Institutes of Health, which also has many, many links to different sites, both at the MayoClinic.com site, as well as American Heart Association, Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, and articles about caffeine in children, teenagers, and women, all over at the Medline site. So there's just more articles than I can talk about in one spot. But let's talk a little bit about caffeine and its specific effects. First of all, caffeine tends to act as a stimulant to the body. It acts as an antagonist of the central nervous system's receptors for the neurotransmitter adenosine. And so these take the place, allow for more dopamine to move across the system and cause you to feel like you're more awake, although your decision-making capacity is not more increased concurrently. It does remove some of the other effects that you make you feel sleepy, and that's why people drink caffeine to try to stay awake. Now, caffeine is also found in so many substances that, you know, you'll just have to check out the different things out there. But one of the things I found was that caffeine levels in most of the energy drinks out there are no higher than the caffeine levels in a large coffee, okay? They are no higher on a single drink basis than the levels you might find in the recommended levels of consumption for the day. So if you have one Red Bull a day or a couple of Red Bulls a day even, you're not even going to be getting over the 500 milligram level of caffeine induction, which is about twice the amount recommended. People who drink a lot of coffee are going to have similar caffeine levels in their body. Now, while caffeine acts as a central nervous system stimulant and increases some levels of alertness in a person, it's the metabolites that break down that may cause other issues after the fact as it's broken down by the liver over time. And this is because it breaks down into three primary products that cause other side effects. Paraxanthine increases lipolysis, basically elevating the level of fatty acids floating around in your blood plasma. And this can be dangerous for people that are increased risk of stroke because these fatty levels are going to be increasing the amount of plaque also on your arterial walls. So anything you can do to reduce the amount of free fatty acid levels and glycerol in your blood is better. Also, theobromine dilates blood vessels and increases urine volume, which of course is what makes you pee when you have caffeine. Caffeine is a diuretic to some extent, although that side effect is much less than the paraxanthine effect. Paraxanthine effects are about 84% compared to 12% theobromine. And then there's a mild amount of theophylline produced. Theophylline, for those of you that don't remember having theophylline as a medication in the field, is a beta agonist and acts on relaxing the bronchi and was used and is used to treat asthma. However, this is not a very large amount of theophylline produced, so I don't expect that you'll see this as a significant effect, but it could have an additive effect when added to people using other beta agonists. It may cause an increased effect of their normal asthma medication, such as albuterol or other direct-acting smooth muscle relaxers in the bronchi. So how much is too much? Well, one of the things that you might want to look at is a link to the MayoClinic.com site, and they talk about when to start cutting out caffeine use. First of all, if you take too much caffeine, and usually this is considered to be more than 500 to 600 milligrams a day. However, this can vary from person to person and is not directly always related to weight. People who have been taking caffeine a long time via their diet can have an increased level of tolerance for caffeine. You can consume moderate amounts of caffeine, but once you get up over that 600 milligram level, you can start to see some side effects. Side effects include restlessness, increased anxiety and irritability. You may start to see muscle tremors, fasciculations, and sleeplessness, headaches, nausea, diarrhea, or other GI problems, and increasing numbers of abnormal heart rhythms. Now, if you see a normally healthy young adult and you have some reason to hook them up to your heart monitor and you know they drink a lot of caffeine, you're likely to see the occasional PVC float by. You're likely to see that they may be mildly tachycardic or have occasional bursts of tachycardia. And this is because of the caffeine. Some people are more sensitive to caffeine, and if that is the case, you need to be aware of that and move to reduce your caffeine intake. The other thing is it can have a negative effect when combined with some antibiotics, including Cipro and Naroxen. These types of antibacterial medications can interfere with the breakdown of caffeine, and of course, this will cause the caffeine to have a longer half-life in the body, stick around longer. Usually, caffeine is removed and absorbed in about 3 or 4 hours. However, in pregnant women, this can go as long as 9 or 10 hours, which is why it's important to reduce caffeine when you're pregnant. And if you take some antibiotics like Cipro and Naroxen, you could be interfering with the breakdown of caffeine in your body. Also, there can be withdrawal symptoms from caffeine. So if you're deciding to cut off caffeine in your diet and you've been drinking a lot of caffeine, you might want to think about reducing slowly over time, going from 3 cups of coffee in the morning to 2 cups of coffee for a couple of days or a week, and then backing that down to 1 cup of coffee before you go entirely to decaf. All of that can be regulated and will cut down on your side effects. Side effects like severe headaches coming from lack of caffeine. Your brain gets used to having that caffeine in there and then suddenly you don't anymore. Well, guess what? One of the reactions is the brain reacts by having a headache. And this is why the drug Excedrin has a combination of medications in it, and one of those combinations is caffeine, because caffeine helps to reduce headache pain. This is something that we won't need to go into now, but just an understanding of how caffeine has been worked into the drug marketplace as well as the food marketplace. So that's a quick look at caffeine. There's a ton of information out there. Use the links I've found. They are, I think, authoritative enough to rely on. Definitely the NIH links out to the Mayo Clinic and other sites are certainly reputable links. And the Wikipedia link has a lot of information about this medication as well. Wow, it looks like we're done. That's going to wrap up another episode of the MedicCast. I want to thank everybody for checking out the show. Don't forget to check out the show notes for links to everything I talked about. And if you want to send in a comment or a question or a correction of anything I've talked about, make sure you do so. You can send it in directly to me here by email at podmedic@mac.com, or you can catch up with me at the voicemail line, MedicCast voicemail line over at 941-306-3342. Also, you can leave comments below any of the posts over at the blog, and I'm going to be getting back in the swing of getting those blog posts up there, so you're going to be looking for a lot more articles from me over the coming months over at the MedicCast site, so stay tuned. I'm looking forward to the second anniversary next week, and I want to urge you to stay tuned and get signed up for the MedicCast newsletter. You can do that by going to the MedicCast site and signing up for the newsletter there. All of that can be found at MedicCast.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the large button banner for the newsletter site. Don't forget about the MedicCast forums over at forums.mediccast.com. The MedicCast forums is a great way for you to extend the conversation a bit. Talk amongst each other, talk around about different topics. I chime in there from time to time as well. All great ways to stay in touch with each other. You can also post your favorite EMS photos there, as well as photos of maybe some new equipment you've gotten in, or maybe your new ambulance. All can be done over at forums.medicast.com. It's free to register, and it's a great way to stay in touch with the medical listeners of the MedicCast site, and I think you'll enjoy it over at forums.medicast.com. Okay, enough of me talking. Time to move on into the end of the show. I'll wrap up, as I always do, with some excellent Podsafe music, this week from a band called Slackstring. I've played some of their music before. You may have listened to the past episodes and heard it. This particular song is a favorite of mine called Sunday Gin. And it's just a nice, relaxing tune, kind of gets you in the mood to kind of just hang out on a weekend. And I thought I would share that with you here. So check out the link in the show notes to the band's website. If you like what you hear, you can let them know you heard it here on the Medicast. And there is a link in the show notes as well to go ahead and purchase that song directly over at iTunes if you are so inclined. You can do that. And I'll leave you with that. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, reminding all of you, until next time, scene safety, BSI.
Monday morning is taking this life away from me. I find myself in the same place again. Staring at the same four walls, screen makes my eyeballs crawl. And no man was made to live the life I'm in. But I won't spend time on your giant clock. My imagination just won't stop. I just can't let this feeling go. I guess I should just ask you so. Sunday, Jane, oh won't you let me come see you tomorrow? Though I know my time is 6 days away. Sunday, yeah, oh this I know. The future can't be borrowed. But there's no one else who makes me feel this way. No sense forcing it, you just got to let it flow. And I can't think to say I let it go. After all this time, after all that we've been through, just one last car on down the avenue. Abstract thoughts on a page were never really my forte. And too much logic is savoir faire for two souls in parallel. Sunday, yeah. Oh, won't you let me come see you tomorrow? Though I know my time is 6 days away. Oh, Sunday, yeah. Won't you let me come see you tomorrow? But there's no one else who makes me feel this way. Come see you tomorrow.